Hello, and thank you for having me. Thank you, Heather and the others, for organizing this event. Thank you to my family for joining me here tonight. I love Washington State and will take any chance to come back and visit, but this is sort of a sad occasion, to be honest. And I'm going to tell you about the story of what it was like to have my home raided by the FBI on September 24th. And then I'm going to talk about what the response to that has been, why we think it happened, and kind of where we're going from here. So Friday, September 24th, I awoke to the sound of a bang at my front door. Bang, bang, bang. And by the time I got downstairs, there were already something like 8 federal agents starting to organize themselves to go through every room of my house. My partner and my daughter were already awake. They were downstairs when the FBI arrived. The agents showed us a search warrant that said that they were looking for evidence of material support to foreign terrorist organizations. And we're going to talk more about what that means as the evening goes on. But they had a list of all kinds of things they could take from my home. They seized computers and my cell phone, my passport, checkbooks and financial records. They seized address books and sign-up lists. They would open up a file folder and look through every page of paper and pick out what they were interested in, anything about Palestine or Colombia or the Anti-War Committee or other organizations that I've worked with. And it took them 4 or 5 hours to go through our house, upstairs, downstairs, the attic, which is only squirrels territory, but and the basement. And they took photographs, like our pictures. They took them from our home. They went through. I had my grandfather died earlier this year, and I have all of his things. And they went through my grandpa's records of his life, and there was nothing that they didn't look at, and they carted away many boxes full of my personal belongings, and they were certainly most focused on and most interested in my activism, my politics, and who do I know, and anything about that they took, along with a few unrelated items, too. When they came to the house, they said we weren't being detained. There were no charges against us, but they didn't want us to use the phone, because they didn't want us to call people to come over and witness what was happening or maybe organize a spontaneous protest against it. I don't know. But I insisted on the right to call my attorney or an attorney friend, and he was actually in New Orleans at a conference for the National Lawyers Guild. He started getting the word out, and within about an hour, something like 20 people gathered on my front lawn. While this was happening, I was hearing my cell phone go off, and a couple of times I was able to see the caller ID, who it was. My friend Meredith was trying to call me, and my friend Mickey was trying to call me, and then they put my phone somewhere where I couldn't see it anymore, but because they wouldn't let me take phone calls when people would call me. And I started to realize that maybe it wasn't only my house that this was happening at. And when people started gathering on the lawn, they told me reports. In fact, my friend Tracy's house, this was happening. And, you know, the media started showing up on the front lawn. It was 7 a.m. I didn't get to do my hair. And I had to start trying to respond to what was happening. The raid was still going on. And we learned from the media that, in fact, there were 6 search warrants being executed in Minneapolis, and we later figured out the 5 people and the offices of the Anti-War Committee were all being raided. And then still later we found out that raids were happening in Chicago as well. 2 different homes in Chicago were being raided. At the end of the search at my house, they handed both myself and my partner a subpoena to appear before a grand jury in Chicago. I'm going to say a little bit more about what I think a grand jury is later. But they all in all gave subpoenas to 14 people between that day and the days following the raids. There were 70 agents involved in the coordinated actions that morning. And not only those homes that I talked about, they were also stopping by some people's houses to just deliver subpoenas. I had a friend in North Carolina whose door they knocked on, and they just wanted to interview him. They asked him to talk about his associations with me and others whose homes were being raided. They knocked on doors in California. They were making phone calls to people in Milwaukee, delivering subpoenas in Michigan. It was a major operation all unfolding at the same time. As I said, people gathered at my home and actually at all of our homes. There was dozens of people at every home to support us. In the week following the raids, there was more than 60 protests, and I know there was at least one here in Seattle. There's maybe been subsequent ones as well. And we've received more than 120 statements of solidarity supporting us. Many of these, as Heather mentioned, have been from unions. There have been people of faith. Actually, the state legislators in Minnesota, about a third of our state legislators signed a letter which they forwarded on to Obama and our federal congressional delegations, condemning the raids of our homes and condemning this grand jury process. We even received letters, like one of my favorite letters we received of support was from an indigenous community in southern Colombia. The fact is that word got out what was happening, and there was just an immediate and resounding response rejecting this. And I think that's because of who we are. So I'm going to tell you more about who we are. Heather told you a lot about who I am. But all of us are anti-war activists. You know, we do things like organize meetings like this one, educational events. We organize demonstrations. We call our politicians and organize call-in days to our senators and representatives. And as Heather mentioned, all of us were folks who helped to organize the anti-war march at the RNC in 2008. The anti-war movement is a big and broad movement. Probably most of you have participated in some anti-war events here in Seattle or elsewhere. Within it, those of us that are being targeted by this series of raids have in common a perspective of international solidarity. And what that means is that we believe that an important part of being against war is to give voice to the people who are under attack. And so we do things like travel to other countries. The Spanish class that Heather mentioned that I took was actually in El Salvador. And we were there because we wanted to understand what Salvadorans thought about U.S. involvement in their country. I have traveled to, 10 years ago, I took a trip to Colombia where I was interested in learning about what Colombians thought about U.S. military aid and what they thought about what were the prospects for peace and justice in their country. And we take these trips and bring back pictures and stories and try to share the voices of the people, like I said, in the places where these wars are happening. And I think that's an important thing to have in the anti-war movement. And it's something that we've made a real priority. The other things about us, 10 of us out of the 14 are union members. Most of us are parents. A lot of us have young children. My daughter is 6 and she's the oldest of the little ones. But my friend Meredith has an 18-month-old daughter. My friend Thistle, who's from Oregon, has a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old. And my friend Tom has a 5-year-old. My friend Hatem has a 5-year-old. And Joe and Stephanie have some teenagers, which they count too. But, you know, I'm just saying, well, most of us are parents. One of the people subpoenaed is a great-grandma, my friend Sarah. Two of the people subpoenaed have spouses who are non-citizen immigrants. And, in fact, in one of the raids, there were documents seized that were from the Immigrants' Rights Coalition in Minneapolis. And some of us are socialists. But all of us are people who are really deeply engaged in our communities and in trying to organize. And I think that was why the immediate outpouring in Minneapolis and Chicago was so substantial. But it really took off, right? And I think this night is a testament to that. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. I want to say a few things about the particular sort of charge, it's not a legal charge, the particular suggestion that we are somehow providing material support to terrorists. That was printed in the local paper in Minneapolis, that my home was raided because I was funding terrorism, or I was suspected of funding terrorism. Imagine what that would mean to you if your coworkers and your neighbors read in the newspaper that you were helping to fund terrorism abroad. It was a smear campaign. I mean, it's not true. In my union, we've been on strike twice in the last 5 years. And the anti-war committee holds yard sales to pay our rent. We're not funding these movements abroad. We are interested in what people in other countries think about what our government is doing. But our role is not to fund them, to send them weapons. In general, we don't even send them T-shirts. You know, I brought you some T-shirts, but nonetheless, we've been charged with material support. And I think that Neil is going to talk later more about that law. But I'll say that what has become clear to me is that it's not only a question of sending money or weapons or T-shirts. It's a question of political support. It's a question of ideas and speech. And in fact, it has become apparent to me, a bunch of law professors in Minneapolis have been published in the paper saying, well, it's maybe not against the law to meet with these people, but I wouldn't suggest it. You know, that the idea that it could be against the law for Americans to travel abroad and meet with people who our government doesn't support. I never imagined that was illegal. I thought that we were free to travel. I thought we were free to associate with whoever we wanted. And I've always believed that we had a right and a responsibility to speak our opinions, and especially to speak and dissent when our government is making mistakes, to speak out against them. And I think that this law, like I said, thank you. I'm going to let Neil get into the nitty-gritty, but there's one last thing I want to say about the material support law, and it's sort of a historical thing. This is a law that was passed in 1996. It kind of got put on steroids after 9/11. But the work that Heather and I did with El Salvador, and certainly the people that did it before us, anyone involved in the Central America movement or the sanctuary movement, churches that gave sanctuary to refugees from Central America, if this law had been in effect in the 80s, would have been subject to prosecution, or certainly at least to suspicion and things like raids, like what happened to me. Similarly, the anti-apartheid movement. The ANC, Nelson Mandela was on the terrorist list until the day he was elected the president of South Africa. Imagine if the entire anti-apartheid movement was somehow under suspicion of terrorism and under suspicion of a crime that allowed federal agents to come into your homes and go through your things, seize your belongings, and accuse you of terrorism, or at least supporting terrorism. In fact, I was asked at a recent event, well, is there anything we can do to challenge who's on the list of terrorist organizations now? It might, in fact, even be a violation of the material support law to lobby our own government that groups like the ANC shouldn't be on it. That groups that may be freedom fighters, when history looks at them, today the government may see them differently. And you and I, our right to even challenge how our government views organizations in other countries is restricted by this law. That said, I personally believe we should be well within our rights to give humanitarian aid, even in places where there's a political conflict, even in places where our government has taken one side in an internal conflict in another country. I personally believe it should be our right and our responsibility to become involved in these places, to travel, to learn, to hear firsthand from the people most affected by what our government is doing, what they believe should happen, what they think the course of events should be, and what peace and justice could look like for them. And I also think that it's the First Amendment to the Constitution, the idea that we have not only a right but a responsibility to speak freely about our opinions about these conflicts in the world. I have recently learned that these rights that I thought I had are not protected, and so here I am. I want to tell you something about that I refuse to tell the FBI, and I won't be telling the grand jury either, about my trip to Colombia. I went there 10 years ago, and I did two things in Colombia. First of all, can I just ask a request? Could you all promise not to tell the FBI if they visit you? Okay. But I've published on the internet and in newspapers my experiences. I'm not hiding them. I don't think they should be subject to some sort of criminal investigation. But I'm going to tell you about it. What did I do? Two things. I went in Bogota. They were having a conference. The social movement, labor unions, environmentalists, student groups, and others were gathering in Bogota to talk about Plan Colombia, which was the U.S. plan for military aid to Colombia. The activists in Colombia believed that it was going to have a huge impact on their ability to work for social change. And that's what they were meeting about. And I went, I was invited to the conference, and I went and I listened to what they hoped for, what they wanted, and how they planned to respond. The other thing that I did, and this is probably the thing that the FBI would really love to talk to me about, is at that time, the Colombian government was in negotiations with the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the largest guerrilla movement or organization in Colombia. The negotiations were happening in a town in southern Colombia, and a part of the process were these public audiences, like a town hall meeting on with different sectors of Colombian society. While I was there, youth from Colombia, from all over, they were coming in on buses from all over the country, were coming to talk about what young people in Colombia thought needed to be a part of the process for resolving the conflict in their country. What they thought peace needed to look like in Colombia. Things like the problems of access to education or employment or health care. And these audiences, these town hall meetings were broadcast on the national news, their cable access station, right? It's the first time in Colombia that this kind of open dialogue has been accessible in the living rooms of Colombian people watching TV, you know? What would happen is the comments from the public audiences would then be brought to the negotiation table, and the government and the FARC would discuss how they could agree, if at all, to address the demands of the population. I was very, as a peace activist, very interested in how Colombians saw peace happening, what they were talking about in terms of trying to make peace in their country. And so I traveled to southern Colombia. I watched the testimony of young people, and I also met the guerrillas who were involved in those talks. And I asked them what they thought the prospects were for peace in Colombia as well. I have to say, I believed that I was within my constitutionally protected rights, within my rights that are protected under international law. The New York Times was there. Diplomats from Europe were there. I thought that I had a right to be there too. That's being called into question. And at the end of the raid on my home, I was handed this subpoena to a grand jury. And they want me to come to the grand jury and to ask me questions about my travels, my political associates here and in Colombia, and the search warrant. They want to see every email I ever sent to somebody in another country, you know. And they want to know, then they do want to know if I've ever said anything or done anything to support people like the FARC. Or the other organization they asked about in my subpoena was the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Now, I believe that both of these organizations are legitimate and that they want justice in their countries. My government doesn't see them the same way, at least not at this point in history. Maybe someday they too will be sitting where Nelson Mandela sits now, but today they're not. I myself and all 14 of us who were subpoenaed initially have taken the stance that we do not want to testify before the grand jury. And there's three reasons. The first reason we don't want to testify before the grand jury is it is a very unfair legal process. And maybe Neil can tell you all about that later, but I was having a chat with my little brother about it. And he said, I thought the grand jury was, you know, grand with a gold-plated jury box and sparkling water instead of tap water, you know, and a really fancy judge. Grand! It's not. In fact, there's not even a judge in a grand jury. The whole thing is run by the prosecutor. He handpicks the jury, and there isn't another lawyer to object if he picks a biased jury, you know? And the whole thing is run in secret. So even though I'm willing to tell you guys all my business here, if I go to the grand jury, I can't tell anyone what I say there or what's asked of me. I don't get to have a lawyer with me. I have to go. I do not know if I'm a target of the grand jury or if I'm being asked to testify against my friends and associates. I don't even know that going in. And yet, I'm expected to go and participate in this very unfair process. I've been told by my lawyer friends that they have a joke amongst themselves that a prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. I'm hoping that being vegetarian will cut me a little slack there, but nonetheless, it's the point of that joke is that it's a very unfair jury, and that's the first reason we're not going to testify. It would be like a, you know, asking for an indictment against ourselves or our friends. But the second reason is I really believe the material support law that they're investigating us under is very unfair. And I don't want to lend testimony against anyone else, certainly not myself, but also anyone else that I've done. I don't think that what we've been doing is wrong. And I don't want to help them convict others of violating an unjust law, an unconstitutional law. And, you know, it's like saying, like in the Jim Crow days, asking you to come to a grand jury and say, did that black man drink from the white drinking fountain? I wouldn't go to the grand jury and testify about that either, because nobody should be convicted of a crime that that shouldn't even have been named in law as a crime. The third reason we don't want to testify before the grand jury has to do with solidarity. Having traveled to Colombia, should I be asked who hosted me, shown pictures and say, did you meet this person in Colombia? The reality is that Colombia is a very dangerous place to be an organizer. As Heather said in introducing me, every day someone is assassinated or imprisoned who are trade unionists, you know, like me. I'm in a union, you know. People who are human rights organizers, mothers of the disappeared. Every day they're treated like criminals, and the idea that my testimony could possibly lead to someone being killed in Colombia just because I remembered them and said that I had, in fact, met them, I couldn't live with that on my conscience. And just so you know, like, I'm not like it's not like fantasy left-wing thinking here. This happened. In the 1980s, the FBI investigated CISPIS, the organization that that Heather and I worked with in the 90s. And in that investigation, they worked hand-in-hand with the Salvadoran National Police. And when they would take the records from CISPIS offices and get the lists of the members or the supporters of these committees around the country, they would then give them to immigration, who would deport any of the Salvadorans on the list, and they would give their names to the Salvadoran National Police. When those people were deported to El Salvador, many of them were killed or disappeared upon their return. So this has happened in our history, in our recent history. And none of us could live with that in our conscience. And so none of us are planning to testify before the grand jury. Our first step in that regard is we were called to appear for different dates in October. And through our attorneys, we communicated to the prosecutor that we'd be pleading the Fifth. That's our right not to testify against ourselves. Since they hadn't told us who they were trying to make a case against, that was a good first answer. But now the prosecutor has started to call people back. And I know that next week, three of my friends from Minneapolis will be notified of when they need to appear before the grand jury. There's a problem with the grand jury system. It's not only that it's not fancy. They can force you to testify or place you in jail. What they can do, and what we think is likely to happen to my three friends next week, is that the prosecutor can impose immunity and say, if you testify, we won't use anything that you say against you in a prosecution against you. Now, we might still prosecute you with the words that those people say about you, but we won't use your words against you in a prosecution. Maybe we won't, but either way, they give you this immunity that's a pretty slim guarantee anyway. And then if you refuse, if you still say, I'm not going to testify, even though you said I'm not going to be jailed for what I say, then they can hold you in contempt of court. And you can be imprisoned for months or years. And that's a very real possibility that my three friends are going to be facing next week, and that I may be facing later. And it's a very big deal for us to make this decision. You know, as we mentioned, I'm a mom, and I can't imagine being taken away from my little daughter, who I love so much. But I also don't know what I would be teaching her if I chose to participate in this process that could end the lives of others. You know, and it's a huge price to pay, but it's a worthwhile price to protect the lives of my friends and associates around the country and around the world, to maybe be separated from my daughter for some time. If the grand jury managed to get indictments against one or more of us and proceeded with a prosecution, I believe that the sentence for violating the material support law is something like 15 years. So the stakes are really high, and we're trying to get out of it. We're trying to stop the grand jury because we think that's the biggest. It sucked to have them going through my house, and I wish they'd give me my phone back and my passport. But really, the real danger to our organizing and our personal lives is the grand jury. And so we are working to build a movement that can help us stop the grand jury proceedings and stop FBI repression, because certainly they visited me on that September 24th. They visited my friends the following week, and they might visit you later. And that shouldn't happen. And finally, a movement that can challenge this material support law, which has no protections for our civil liberties as I used to understand them. We're doing this through a couple ways. One is political pressure, and I'm going to start passing around, or maybe Heather could help me pass around this clipboard. We're sending postcards to President Obama, asking him to intervene on our behalf. It's his Justice Department that's pursuing this case against us, and he can do that. So everybody sign a postcard before you go, please. We've been asked, had several national call-in days where people have called President Obama or Attorney General Eric Holder and asked them to intervene on our behalf. And finally, we've had a legislative campaign, and we're expecting that next week my representative, Keith Ellison, who's from Minneapolis, will be coming out. Well, he is sending a letter to Eric Holder on our behalf. We're hoping they'll be able to pull together a Dear Colleague letter, which, in fact, your senators and representatives could sign on to. It's like a thing that the Congress people do. They sign, one person writes a letter, and then they all sign it, or hopefully a lot of them, and then they send it on. It has a little more weight than from one individual. We're trying to struggle with the legislators, all of our senators and representatives, in particular in Illinois and Minnesota. And as we get them signed on, we're going to be asking people out here in Washington and around the country to work to get your senators and representatives to back these same efforts. And finally, we're trying to just build a broad base of support. It's true, like I'm this, you know, crazy anti-war activist that traveled to Colombia and met with these crazy people. But the risk that is posed by our rights being limited, the rights of the 14 of us being limited, it reaches out much further than us. And I know that some of the other speakers are going to talk about that, but we really think that our best defense is to make it politically untenable for them to prosecute us, for them to pursue us. And that's by them knowing that you guys won't let them. And this is the very last thing I'm going to say, which is that I do think that there could be many reasons they might be carrying out this campaign against us. But certainly one thing that they hope for is to chill dissent, to make all of us more afraid to speak out and to come together and to organize around the issues that are important to us. But I like to say I'm now from Minnesota, and it is very cold in Minnesota. And we just put on some long johns and wrap on a scarf, and go and keep doing what we're doing. The most important thing is that the anti-war movement and other movements not be stopped in our tracks by these kind of aggressions against us. And if they fail to silence us, and if they fail to silence you, then I think that is our best defense for all of us to not face similar actions in the future. So I want to thank you again for having me. I'm sure I talked longer than Heather said I would. But it's really great to be here at home in Washington State and talking with all of you. So thank you.